windmilling her arms as she struggled to balance on one leg. The rough stone had scuffed her bare feet. Ned stopped and looked at her. "Arya? What are you doing?" "Sirio says a water dancer can stand on one toe for hours." Her hands flailed at the air to steady herself. Ned had to smile. "Which toe?" he teased. "Any toe," Arya said, exasperated with the question. She hopped from her right leg to her left, swaying dangerously before she regained her balance. "Must you do your standing here?" he asked. "It's a long, hard fall down these steps." "Sirio says a water dancer never falls." She lowered her leg to stand on 2 feet. "Father, will Bran come and live with us now?" "Not for a long time, sweet one," he told her. "He needs to win his strength back." Arya bit her lip. "What will Bran do when he's of age?" Ned knelt beside her. "He has years to find that answer, Arya. For now it is enough to know that he will live." The night the bird had come from Winterfell, Eddard Stark had taken the girls to the castle Godswood, an acre of elm and alder and black cottonwood overlooking the river. The heart tree there was a great oak, its ancient limbs overgrown with smokeberry vines. They knelt before it to offer their thanksgiving, as if it had been a weirwood. Sansa drifted to sleep as the moon rose. Arya, several hours later, curling up in the grass under Ned's cloak. All through the dark hours he kept his vigil alone. When dawn broke over the city, the dark red blooms of dragon's breath surrounded the girls where they lay. "I dreamt of Bran," Sansa had whispered to him. "I saw him, smiling." "He was going to be a knight," Arya was saying now, "a knight of the King's Guard. Can he still be a knight?" "No," Ned said. He saw no use in lying to her. "Yet some day he may be the lord of a great holdfast and sit on the king's council. He might raise castles like Brandon the Builder, or sail a ship across the sunset sea, or enter your mother's faith and become the High Septon." "But he will never run beside his wolf again," he thought with a sadness too deep for words, "or lie with a woman, or hold his own son in his arms." Arya cocked her head to one side. "Can I be a king's counselor and build castles and become the High Septon?" "You," Ned said, kissing her lightly on the brow, "will marry a king and rule his castle, and your sons will be knights and princes and lords, and yes, perhaps even a High Septon." Arya screwed up her face. "Nah," she said, "that's Sansa." She folded up her right leg and resumed her balancing. Ned sighed and left her there. Inside his chambers, he stripped off his sweat-stained silks and sluiced cold water over his head from a basin beside the bed. Alan entered as he was drying his face. "My lord," he said, "Lord Baelish is without and begs audience." "Escort him to Myrcella," Ned said, reaching for a fresh tunic, the lightest linen he could find. "I'll see him at once." Littlefinger was perched on the window seat when Ned entered, watching the knights of the King's Guard practice at swords in the yard below. "If only old Selmy's mind was nimble as his blade," he said wistfully, "our council meetings would be a great deal livelier." "Sir Barristan is as valiant and honourable as any man in the King's Landing." Ned had come to have a deep respect for the aged, white-haired Lord Commander of the King's Guard. "And as tiresome," Littlefinger added, "though I dare say he should do well in the tourney. Last year he unhorsed the Hound, and it was only 4 years ago he was champion." The question of who might win the tourney interested Eddard Stard not in the least. "Is there any reason for this visit, Lord Petar? Or are you simply here to enjoy the view from my window?" Littlefinger smiled. "I promised Cat I would help you in your inquiries, and so I have." That took Ned aback. Promise or no promise, he could not find it in him to trust Lord Petar Baelish, who struck him as too clever by half. You have something for me? Someone, Littlefinger corrected. Four someones, if truth be told. Had you thought to question the hand's servants? Ned frowned. Would that I could. Lady Aaron took her household back to the Eyrie. Lysa has done him no favour in that regard. All those who had stood closest to her husband had gone with her when she fled. John's maester, his steward, the captain of his guard, his knights and retainers. Most of her household, Littlefinger said. Not all. A few remain. A pregnant kitchen girl, hastily wed to one of Lord Renly's grooms, a stable hand who joined the city watch, a potboy discharged from service for theft, and Lord Aaron's squire. His squire? Ned was pleasantly surprised. A man's squire often knew a great deal of his comings and goings. Sir Hugh of the Vale, Littlefinger named him. The king knighted the boy after Lord Aaron's death. I shall send for him, Ned said, and the others. Littlefinger winced. My lord, step over here to the window, if you will be so kind. Why? Come, and I'll show you, my lord. Frowning, Ned crossed to the window. Pataia Baelish made a casual gesture. There, across the yard, at the door of the armory, do you see the boy squatting by the steps honing a sword with an oilstone? What of him? He reports to Varys. The spider has taken a great interest in you and all your doings. He shifted in the window seat. Now glance at the wall farther west, above the stables. The guardsman leaning on the ramparts? Ned saw the man. Another of the eunuch's whisperers? No, this one belongs to the queen. Notice that he enjoys a fine view of the door to this tower, the better to note who calls on you. There are others, many unknown even to me. The Red Keep is full of eyes. Why do you think I hid Cat in a brothel? Eddard Stark had no taste for these intrigues. Seven hells, he swore. It did seem as though the man on the walls was watching him. Suddenly uncomfortable, Ned moved away from the window. Is everyone someone's informer in this cursed city? Scarcely, said Littlefinger. He counted on the fingers of his hand. Why, there's me, you, the king. Although, come to think of it, the king tells the queen much too much, and I'm less than certain about you. He stood up. Is there a man in your service that you trust utterly and completely? Yes, said Ned. Oh, in that case, I have a delightful palace in Valeria I would dearly love to sell you. Littlefinger said with a mocking smile. The wiser answer was no, my lord. But be that as it may, send this paragon of yours to Sir Hugh and the others. Your own comings and goings will be noted, but even Varys the Spider cannot watch every man in your service every hour of the day. He started for the door. Lord Pataia, Ned called after him, I am grateful for your help. Perhaps I was wrong to distrust you. Littlefinger fingered his small pointed beard. You are slow to learn, Lord Eddard. Distrusting me was the wisest thing you've done since you climbed down off your horse. John was showing Darren how best to deliver a side stroke when the new recruit entered the practice yard. Your feet should be further apart, he urged. I don't want to lose your balance. That's good. Now pivot as you deliver the stroke. Get all your weight behind the blade. Darren broke off and lifted his visor. Seven gods, he murmured. Would you look at this, John? John turned. Through the eye slit of his helm, he beheld the fattest boy he had ever seen standing in the doorway of the armory. By the look of him, he must have weighed 20 stone. The fur collar of his embroidered surcoat was lost beneath his chins. Pale eyes moved nervously in a great round moon of a face, and plump, sweaty fingers wiped themselves on the velvet of his doublet. They told me I was to come here for training, he said to no one in particular. A lordling, Pip observed to John. Southern, most like, near High Garden. Pip had travelled the Seven Kingdoms with a mummer's troop, and bragged that he could tell what you were and where you'd been born just from the sound of your voice. A striding huntsman had been worked in scarlet thread upon the breast of the fat boy's fur-trimmed surcoat. John did not recognise the sigil. Sir Alistair Thorne looked over his new charge and said, "It would seem they've run short of poachers and thieves down south. Now they send us pigs to man the wall. Is fur and velvet your notion of armour, my lord of Hem?" It was soon revealed that the new recruit had brought his own armour with him. Padded doublet, boiled leather, mail and plate and helm, even a great wood and leather shield blazoned with the same striding huntsman he wore in his surcoat. As none of it was black, however, Sir Alistair insisted that he re-equip himself from the armoury. That took half the morning. His girth required Donal Noy to take apart a mail hauberk and refit it with leather panels at the side. To get a helm over his head, the armourer had to detach the visor. His leathers bound so tightly around his legs and under his arms that he could scarcely move. Dressed for battle, the new boy looked like an overcooked sausage about to burst its skin.
"Well, let us hope that you're not as inept as you look," Sir Alistair said. "Halder, see what Sir Piggy can do."
John Snow winced. Halder had been born in a quarry and apprenticed as a stonemason. He was 16, tall and muscular, and his blows were as hard as any John had ever felt. "This will be uglier than a whore's arse," Pip muttered, and it was. The fight lasted less than a minute before the fat boy was on the ground, his whole body shaking as blood leaked through his shattered helm and between his pudgy fingers.
"I yield," he shrilled. "No more! I yield! Don't hit me!"
Rass and some of the other boys were laughing. Even then Sir Alistair would not call an end.
"On your feet, Sir Piggy," he called. "Pick up your sword."
When the boy continued to cling to the ground, Thorne gestured to Halder.
"Hit him with the flat of your blade until he finds his feet."
Halder delivered a tentative smack to the foe's upraised cheeks.
"You can hit harder than that," Thorne taunted.
Halder took hold of his longsword with both hands and brought it down so hard the blow split leather, even on the flat. The new boy screeched in pain. Jon Snow took a step forward. Pip laid a mailed hand on his arm.
"Jon, no,"
the small boy whispered with an anxious glance at Sir Alistair Thorne.
"On your feet,"
Thorne repeated. The fat boy struggled to rise, slipped and fell heavily again.
"Sir Piggy is starting to grasp the notion," Sir Alistair observed. "Again?"
Halder lifted the sword for another blow.
"Cut us off, Am,"
Rast urged, laughing. John shook off Pip's hand.
"Halder, enough!"
Halder looked to Sir Alistair.
"The bastard speaks, and the peasants tremble,"
the Master of Arms said in that sharp, cold voice of his.
"I remind you that I am the Master at Arms here, Lord Snow."
"Look at him, Halder," John urged, ignoring Thorne as best he could. "There's no honour in beating a fallen foe. He yielded." He knelt beside the fat boy. Halder lowered his sword. "He yielded," he echoed. Sir Alistair's onyx eyes were fixed on John Snow.
"It would seem our bastard is in love," he said, as John helped the fat boy to his feet. "Show me your steel, Lord Snow."
John drew his longsword. He dared defy Sir Alistair only to a point, and he feared he was well beyond it now.
Thorne smiled. "The bastard wishes to defend his lady love, so shall we make an exercise of it? Rat, Pimple, help our stonehead here."
Rast and Albert moved to join Halder.
"Three of you ought to be sufficient to make Lady Piggy squeal. All you need do is get past the bastard."
"Stay behind me," John said to the fat boy. Sir Alistair had often sent two foes against him, but never three. He knew he would likely go to sleep, bruised and bloody tonight. He braced himself for the assault. Suddenly, Pip was beside him. 3-2 will make for far better sport, the small boy said cheerfully. He dropped his visor and slid out his sword. Before John could even think to protest, Gren had stepped up to make a third. The yard had grown deathly quiet. John could feel Sir Alistair's eyes.
Why are you waiting?
He asked Rest and the others, in a voice gone deceptively soft. But it was John who moved first. Halder barely got his sword up in time. John drove him backward, attacking with every blow, keeping the older boy on the heels. Know your foe, Sir Roderick had taught him once. John knew Halder, brutally strong but short of patience, with no taste for defence. Frustrate him, and he would leave himself open, as certain as sunset. The clang of steel echoed through the yard as the others joined battle around him. John blocked a savage cut at his head, the shock of impact running up his arm as the swords crashed together. He slammed a side stroke into Halder's ribs and was rewarded with a muffled grunt of pain. The counterstroke caught John on the shoulder. Chainmail crunched and pain flared up his neck, but for an instant Halder was unbalanced. John cut his left leg from under him and he fell with a curse and a crash. Gren was standing his ground, as John had taught him, giving Albert more than he cared for, but Pip was hard-pressed. Rast had 2 years and 40 pounds on him. John stepped up behind him and rang the raper's helm like a bell. As Rast went reeling, Pip slid in under his guard, knocking him down, and levelled a blade at his throat. By then John had moved on, facing two swords. Albert backed away. "I yield!" he shouted. Sir Alistair Thorne surveyed the scene with disgust.
"The Mummers' Farce has gone on long enough for today."
He walked away. The session was at an end. Darren helped Halder to his feet. The quarryman's son wrenched off his helm and threw it across the yard. "For an instant, I thought I finally had you, Snow." "For an instant you did," John replied. Under his mail and leather, his shoulder was throbbing. He sheathed his sword and tried to remove his helm, but when he raised his arm, the pain made him grit his teeth.
"Let me," a voice said. Thick-fingered hands unfastened helm from gorget and lifted it off gently. "Did he hurt you?"
"Well, I've been bruised before." He touched his shoulder and winced. The yard was emptying around them. Blood mattered the fat boy's hair, where Halder had split his helm asunder.
"My name is Samuel Tarley, of Horn—"
He stopped and licked his lips.
I mean, I was of Horn Hill until I left. I've come to take the black. My father is Lord Randall, a bannerman to the Tyrrells of Highgarden. I used to be his heir, only—"
His voice trailed off. "I'm Jon Snow, Ned Stark's bastard, of Winterfell." Samuel Tarley nodded.
If you want, you can call me Sam. My mother calls me Sam."
"You can call him Lord Snow," Pip said, as he came up to join him. "You don't want to know what his mother calls him."
"These two are Gren and Pippa," John said.
"Gren's the ugly one," Pip said.
Gren scowled. "You're uglier than me. At least I don't have ears like a bat."
"My thanks to all of you," the fat boy said gravely. "Why didn't you get up and fight?" Gren demanded. I wanted to, truly. I just couldn't. I didn't want him to hit me any more." He looked at the ground. I fear I'm a coward. My lord father always said so."
Gren looked thunderstruck. Even Pip had no words to say to that, and Pip had words for everything. What sort of a man would proclaim himself a coward? Samuel Tarley must have read their thoughts on their faces. His eyes met John's and darted away, quick as frightened animals.
I'm sorry, he said. I don't mean to be like I am.
He walked heavily towards the armory. John called after him. "You were hurt," he said. "Tomorrow you'll do better." Sam looked mournfully back over one shoulder.
"No, I won't," he said, blinking back tears. "I never do better."
When he was gone, Gren frowned. "Nobody likes Craven," he said uncomfortably. "I wish we hadn't helped him. What if they think we're Craven, too?"
"You're too stupid to be Craven," Pip told him.
"I am not," Gren said.
"Yes, you are. If a bear attacked you in the woods, you'd be too stupid to run away."
"I would not," Gren insisted. "I'd run away faster than you." He stopped suddenly, scowling when he saw Pip's grin and realized what he'd just said. His thick neck flushed a dark red, and John left them there, arguing as he returned to the armory, hung up his sword, and stripped off his battered armor. Life at Castle Black followed certain patterns. The mornings were for swordplay, the afternoons for work. The Black Brothers set new recruits to many different tasks, to learn where their skills lay. John cherished the rare afternoons when he was sent out with Ghost, ranging at his side, to bring back game for the Lord Commander's table, but for every day spent hunting, he gave a dozen to Donald Noy in the armory, spinning the whetstone while the one-armed smith sharpened axes, grown dull from use, or pumping the bellows as Noy hammered out a new sword. Other times he ran messages, stood at guard, mucked out stables, fletched arrows, assisted Maester Aemon with his birds, or Bowen Marsh with his counts and inventories. That afternoon, the watch commander sent him to the winch cage, with 4 barrels of fresh crushed stone to scatter gravel over the icy footpaths atop the wall. It was lonely and boring work, even with Ghost along for company. But John found he did not mind. On a clear day, you could see half the world from the top of the wall, and the air was always cold and bracing. He could think here, and he found himself thinking of Samwell Tarly, and Udley of Tyrion Lannister. He wondered what Tyrion would have made of the fat boy. And most men would rather deny a hard truth than face it, the dwarf had told him, grinning. The world was full of cravens who pretended to be heroes. It took a queer sort of courage to admit to cowardice, as Samwell Tarly had. His sore shoulder made the work go slowly. It was late afternoon before John finished graveling the paths. He lingered on high to watch the sun go down, turning the western sky the color of blood. Finally, as dusk was settling over the north, John rolled the empty barrels back into the cage and signaled the winchmen to lower him. The evening meal was almost done by the time he and Ghost reached the common hall. A group of the Black Brothers were dicing over mulled wine near the fire. His friends were at a bench near the west wall, laughing. Pip was in the middle of a story. The mummer's boy, with the big ears, was a born liar with 100 different voices, and he did not tell his stories so much as live them, playing all the parts as needed, a king one moment and a swineherd the next. When he turned into an alehouse girl or a virgin princess, he used a high falsetto voice that reduced them all to tears of helpless laughter, and his eunuchs were always eerily accurate caricatures of Sir Alistair. John took as much pleasure from Pip's antics as anyone, yet that night he turned away and went instead to the end of the bench, where Samwell Tarly sat alone, as far from the others as he could get. He was finishing the last of the pork pie the cooks had served up for supper when John sat down across from him. The fat boy's eyes widened at the sight of Ghost.
"Is that a wolf?"
"A direwolf," John said. "His name is Ghost. The direwolf is the sigil of my father's house."
"Ours is a striding huntsman," Samwell Tarly said.
"Do you like to hunt?"
Oh, the fat boy shuddered. "Oh, I ate it."
He looked as though he was going to cry again. "What's wrong now?" John asked. "Why are you always so frightened?" Sam stared at the last of his pork pie and gave a feeble shake of his head, too scared even to talk. A burst of laughter filled the hall. John heard Pip squeaking in a high voice. He stood. "Let's go outside." The round fat face looked up at him, suspicious.
"Why? What will we do outside?"
"Talk," John said. "Have you seen the wall?"
"I'm fat, not blind," Samwell Tarly said. "Of course I saw it. It's 700 feet high."
Yet he stood up all the same, wrapped a fur-lined cloak around his shoulders, and followed John from the common hall, still wary, as if he suspected some cruel trick was waiting for him in the night. Ghost padded along beside them.
"I never thought it would be like this," Sam said as they walked, his words steaming in the cold air. Already he was huffing and puffing as he tried to keep up. "All the buildings are falling down, and it's so
cold." A hard frost was settling over the castle, and John could hear the soft crunch of grey weeds beneath his boots. Sam nodded miserably.
"I hate the cold," he said. "Last night I woke up in the dark, and the fire had gone out, and I was certain I was going to freeze to death by morning."
"It must have been warmer where you come from."
"I never saw snow until last month. We were crossing the Barrowlands, me and the men my father sent to see me north.